One thing I will say this movie features prominently is how much social media controls everything we do. I mean, it's almost like the Wild West, except instead of guns, everybody has a cell phone. You know, they're obsessed with filming things, having it record everything that they're doing, letting it tell them what to think. And then, of course, in the end, there's the AI super center, whatever it is, data center. So, I mean, they kind of, there's a little bit of a judgment in there, which I think was actually pretty apt. Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Eddington and Life of Chuck, beginning with Eddington. Now, this is an Ari Aster film. So, Mike, I'm sure you want to start there.
Well, I like this pairing of films because they both raise important questions about genre. And of course, as film academics, we're always thinking about genre and, you know, which films neatly fit within a box and which don't. And some of the most interesting films don't quite fit in the box or they cross categories. And I think both of the films today raise issues relating to that. Now, Eddington, as Marie mentioned, it's from writer-director Ari Aster. He's best known for the film Midsommar from 2019. So, you know, in a tight spot, I'd say, well, it's a horror film. But then as you start to talk about it, it's not quite as cut and dried as that. And that's actually a good thing. And one important aspect of his work, certainly, is there's a tonal quality. By that, I mean there's a certain mood or tone or atmosphere he establishes. And it's usually within a particular genre, though, again, we'll raise some issues with that. This film today, Eddington, I think actually raises those issues in a kind of overdrive way. And it's not entirely a good thing from my perspective here. If somebody says, well, what is it? I'd say, well, it's a contemporary Western. I mean, that you know, it's set in New Mexico. And in fact, Aster himself grew up there, so he knows the turf. And yet, when is it set? And I say, well, present day, or I say, well, actually near present. It takes place in 2020, May of 2020. Months matter here because it's just 3 months into the COVID pandemic. And so it's kind of near present. So it's a dystopian film set in the near present, which in some ways is our present or the aftermath of it. And so that's kind of quirky right there. In a nutshell, which is actually almost impossible with this film to try to say something in a nutshell, but the gist of it is there's a crusty sheriff, Joe Cross, played by Joaquin Phoenix, and he's in this fictional New Mexico town, and he's been jousting with the mayor, Ted Garcia, played by Pedro Pascal. And essentially, it's a fight between the right and the left. The sheriff is this crusty, like if this film had been made decades ago, it'd be like a John Wayne kind of character, right? He's just going to do things his own way. And, you know, he's not going to listen to the government authorities and so much for masking. He doesn't like masking during the pandemic. He doesn't like masks either on bad guys or even on good guys. And so there's that kind of premise for it, that he's just this crusty individualist, and he's going to be up against the mayor, who is more or less a liberal, I'll say, but kind of like in a squeaky clean, you know, big smile, let's all work together kind of way, and perhaps superficial. Now, let's start to pick it apart in terms of genre. So it's going to work as a Western, more or less, certainly the setting and the title character. It also is going to be a sort of political satire because it takes aim at all sides. It's not one of these films where you feel like it's on a soapbox arguing for the right or the left. It makes fun of the guy on the right and the guy on the left. So, okay, equal opportunity that way. And then there's some family drama, which Marie and I can talk about in terms of the sheriff and his relationships. In other words, once you start adding on genre elements, or at least scripted elements, there's a lot that piles on here. And then what finally happens is that I loved in the New York Times review where they referred to the film sort of, you know, slipping or sliding or catapulting out of control at a certain point. And the New York Times critic referred to it as, quote unquote, violent slapstick. And it really does get to like a really silly point, almost like a Coen Brothers kind of silliness with the violent extremes there. Now, all those elements for me are interesting, and there's a lot percolating here. But I got to tell you, I think it does go into a kind of overdrive where it just seems like, well, is it really resolved? Does it know what it's doing even? It's just like throwing all these elements in. And what really sinks it for me after a while is, and I know I sort of fixate on running times, but 148 minutes. I mean, there's a lot of it. If it had come in maybe a half hour shorter, I might be kinder towards it. But I was starting to lose patience with the film. So before y'all lose patience with me, let me turn it over to you.
So it's a COVID movie that never, ever mentions the word COVID, which is clever because that means, you know, it can work in other, you know, it doesn't have to be about COVID. It could be about any sort of pandemic situation. It's such a weird movie in so many ways. And I agree with you about the running time. I felt mostly that Emma Stone, much as I love her, you could have deleted her character entirely. And just had, you know, she, you know, ran off or she was in a mental institution, just anything. And they just kind of started with, you know, her mom was still living there. The mom character I thought was absolutely great and, you know, completely obsessed with conspiracy theories. But just the way they depicted her was so interesting. I thought all the characters were really interesting. Now, the chaos of the movie, I want to mention that I read that the director gave everybody different scripts of what was going to happen. So everybody truly was very confused and surprised by the way things unfolded because it wouldn't have, you know, matched what they were given. So, and also another cool detail is if you take a look at the town's billboard that says Eddington welcomes you, there's a subtle flicker with Morse code that says, this isn't real.
Well, again, it's full of fascinating details and intriguing characters, but does it gel? Does it cohere? And no, it doesn't at all. And so when you mentioned the Emma Stone character, she plays Sheriff Joe's wife, Louise. And this is, again, like a sort of quasi character. She's defined by character quirks. She makes these, like, when you use the word weird, she makes these weird dolls, right? Which are never like fully explained, but it's just like this dangling detail. It's like, huh, that's interesting. Almost like a kind of bizarre folk art or something. She makes these things. And there are other characters like that who sort of have defining traits. Now, I do agree also with Louise's mother, played by Deirdre O'Connell, who she actually is one of the more interesting aspects of the film because this woman, and it seems so true to life, she's totally obsessed with conspiracy theories. And she's moved in with her daughter and son-in-law, and they're not exactly thrilled about that, but you got to take mom in, right? So she's living there. And so those are like really queasy and funny scenes, like just sitting in the living room and whatever's on TV, she goes off on this sermon about, oh, well, you know, and at the dinner table. I mean, talk about loaded topics at the dinner table. She can find a conspiracy theory in anything. And that actually does play to the advantage of the film in the sense that we are looking to make connections, aren't we? And I don't think the film itself does a good job of that, but it has the right mindset in that, well, how does this relate to that? What does all this mean? And the mother, of course, is only too willing to throw ideas our way. I can sort of see how the wheels are spinning with that. But gosh, I wish they were spinning a little more efficiently or just cogently. In other words, it's a dangerous territory to get into because so much gets tossed in here. Before, when I was mentioning all the elements, I didn't even get to two of the other elements that get tossed in. Because of the setting of the film, the George Floyd murder figures prominently, as it did in American culture and still does. But at that time, in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement, what happens when that, what we think of as an essentially, and I shouldn't say essentially, urban movement, but where actual protests were pretty much taking place in cities. What if protests like that spread to like a really distant small town in New Mexico and you had, you know, pickets on the street? How would this old line crusty sheriff respond to that? So that, I mean, that's all valid subject matter for sure, but it just gets sort of tossed in there. And when you mentioned like Morse code, this is not real. Some of those scenes really didn't seem real to me, right? They really seemed staged as in not so much people staging a protest rally as the director staging a protest rally on the street. There's a distinction there. So I start to feel like the fictional element is overtly fictional, if you will, in a way. But this another element that I hadn't mentioned before is that one of the issues facing this town is a proposed data center. And we're aware of that in Maryland, too, of course. When these come in, yes, they offer employment. Yes, they offer, you know, AI and all sorts of high tech stuff. But of course, they consume a lot of energy. They do sort of literally change the landscape. And so that's actually a jousting point. But you know what? In this film, it's actually sort of at the heart or among the issues that the sheriff and the mayor are going to argue over. And it's there, but I say like there and not there. So like there are stretches of the film where it just doesn't seem to matter, just kind of drops out. And then without spoiling anything, by the end of the film, it's going to prominently be there again for us. But that's, again, a case where there are so many cards in this deck. It's not even a matter of how much they're being, shuffled. These cards are being sort of like thrown into the desert. They're like landing here and there. And it strikes me, frankly, after a while, as arbitrary. Like, do I come away with anything meaningful in terms of anything from George Floyd to a proposed data center? To any number of other things. And to me, it just seems like a lot of loose ends that haven't quite been pulled together. Now, on the one hand, I don't like movies that are so neatly resolved that they're neatly tied up with a ribbon and a bow and everything resolved and, you know, a happy or at least a resolved ending. But this is the opposite extreme. This is a film where I think there's just too much tossed out there. It's like whatever occurred to the writer director is like, oh, yeah, you know, that's of the moment. That's zeitgeist. Let's do that. And I think after a while, this viewer at least kind of loses patience with it. I know these are all valid concerns, but it's just like having all that spinning around in a blender. What do you end up with?
Well, in a way, you end up with a big mess. But knowing that he made Midsommar, I wasn't quite as surprised as I would have been at the way this ended, just because I thought that movie also at the end just went super surreal. One thing I will say this movie features prominently is how much social media controls everything we do. I mean, it's almost like the Wild West, except instead of guns, everybody has a cell phone. You know, they're obsessed with filming things, having it record everything that they're doing, letting it tell them what to think. And then, of course, in the end, there's the AI super center, whatever it is, data center. So, I mean, they kind of, there's a little bit of a judgment in there, which I think was actually pretty apt.
Yeah, that's a really good point you make, because, for instance, with the George Floyd related street protests, the fact that they have spread to this little town, well, that's because of social media as much as anything, right? You know, as people tell their friends and it spreads that way. And then once people are actually holding up picket signs and blocking a street and all that and going, you know, mano a mano with the sheriff, people are there, you know, they are themselves documenting the protest and, you know, however that might be used legally or at least through further social media. And for that matter, the conspiracy theory obsessed mother-in-law, where is she getting her information? You know, I mean, she's getting it off TV news, but also, you know, social media and so on. And that's where the facts or alternative facts kind of take on a life of their own, and it spins that way. So I actually think within the film, if there's anything that holds it together, or at least theoretically holds it together, I think you may have identified it, that that's something that is a connecting thread all the way through. I'm stubborn. I'm not quite willing to concede that much cohesion to the film, but I can see that as a kind of like conceptual framework for it.
So I wanted to ask you if you noticed this thing that they kept doing with Emma Stone's character, which was, I don't know if they never did or barely did, but they were hardly ever focusing on her straight on. It was almost always through a reflection or a mirror, a screen. I mean, I know he's a very arty kind of director, so that might have been the reason for it. But since she was so fragile, I just wondered if that was an intentional decision.
I'm assuming it was intentional, and I'm feeling that it's a mistake in the sense that we spent a lot of time with the sheriff. And you know, he certainly gets to, so many opportunities to express himself gruffly or just to drive along through the desert. That's a lot of screen time with him. Many of the secondary characters, which would include his own wife, are almost tangential at times. This is where you have a secondary character defined by a few traits, whether it's fragility or doll making or however you want to put this. And those characters aren't given their full due. And in a technical sense, you make a good observation. It's almost like, well, we're going to shoot her from the side or we're going to, you know, not show her in full. And that's where I don't feel like she's fully realized as a character. And even that really interesting mother-in-law character, the conspiracy theorist, that she's, I won't say she's one note because she's full of all sorts of notes of conspiracy, but in a sense, one note in that she's kind of defined that way. I mean, think about it by way of like a character backstory or amplitude of character. There's not a lot there. I mean, the mayor, for instance. You know, we know the glib image, you know, it's literally a billboard image, right? And the guy's like a living embodiment of the billboard, you know, the smiling glad-hander kind of thing. And that's all true to life in a lot of ways for many politicians. But you couldn't really say too much more about him. Know what I'm getting at? There's not, if you try to like just say, well, gee, what's his life like? And why does he have this belief or that one? Those are givens in a hasty way. It's not a film that's going to, see, this is one of the problems with having so many things on the plate. And nothing is developed as fully as it might be, including, you know, your observations about the role of social media. That is something that could really hold the film together. But gosh, there are times where it's prominent and other times where the film goes off on some other tangent.
Mm-hmm. I did think that there were certain moments in the film that were genuinely hilarious. There was some really funny dialogue. I just want to make sure the audience knows it's not super serious all the time. I mean, it is satirical and funny in parts. And I laughed every single time one of the characters who was, you know, stubbornly wearing a mask, but not over their nose. I mean, it really wasn't on. I thought that was hilarious every time I saw it.
There's some really funny stuff there. And it's like nostalgic funny in the sense of when we think about pandemic related restrictions, you know, we all spent time like in a supermarket line where, and the one that always made me smile was, yes, somebody had the mask on, but they were wearing it like a necklace. You know, I thought, well, it doesn't do you any good when it's just around. No, I'm serious. It doesn't do you any good when it's just hanging around your neck. You know, you're supposed to have your nose and mouth. Right? But I wasn't going to be like the policeman there and say, sir, please pull that up. But there were confrontations that, you know, sometimes made the news even. And this is actually, all joking aside, this is where the sheriff and the mayor go head to head, because the sheriff, when the sheriff walks into like a fast food store or convenience store or whatever, he's not going to wear a mask. Meantime, the employees and the customers are all masked. And this is, you know, May 2020. So this is, you know, no laughs involved here. People, you know, had mandates to do that. And the sheriff refuses to do it. So there's a lot of incremental detail there that does register as a quasi documentary in a way, isn't it? It sort of takes us back to what that moment was like and people who, you know, rugged individuals who absolutely refused to mask up. And this is a serious issue actually for a sheriff, because he's riding around town, you know, stopping people for traffic violations or whatever. And sometimes like the people he's interacting with are masked, but he's not. And you know, you can understand why the mayor would say, you know, we have like, you know, state law in this or whatever. And this is where it becomes, you know, joking aside, a reminder of what some of the actual confrontations were like back then. So it's to the credit of the writer director here that he's able to evoke all that.
And without resolving it one way or the other, you're pretty sure the homeless guy has COVID.
I would assume so. I would assume so.
Just all that coughing.
Well, that's another thing, like how to respond to a cough, right? even now, as you know, like we have Zoom meetings and all, if somebody coughs at the other end, I pull back a little bit, like, you know, don't cough on me.
Now, I wonder if it was a strategic mistake to make a movie about the pandemic when people don't really want to remember it.
Well, you know, I love that question, Marie, because it for many people, it's so much in the rearview mirror that they don't want to be reminded at all. And they want to act like somehow it's some distant chapter. And this is actually, you know, from a creative standpoint, films now, to what extent should we acknowledge that it occurred, and to what extent just move on? And so, again, it's also to the credit of this film that it overtly takes us back to what, after all, was just, you know, as you and I speak, just 5 years ago. That's pretty recent. And yet, when you think about it, very few films nowadays really acknowledge that, right? I mean, it's just not, when you think about like people talking about their careers and lives and this and that, very, very few films being released in the last several years have any acknowledgement of it. It's like we've moved on, haven't we?
Yeah, I think a lot of people want to keep it that way. Speaking of moving on, let's move on to The Life of Chuck. Speaking of billboards, because billboards figure prominently into this movie, which is told in three acts, which is meant to mirror a sonata, Where do you want to start with Life of Chuck?
Well, let me start with a personal observation of a slight connection I have to the filmmaker. The writer-director, Mike Flanagan, grew up in Bowie. He studied film at Towson University. I interviewed him in the year 2000, since we're going back in time. I interviewed him in the year 2000 when he was a 21-year-old Towson University film major when I interviewed him. And the reason I was doing the interview was he, on campus, had made a feature-length film that was being shown in that year's Maryland Film Festival. So he and I, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, that status as a student filmmaker, you know, being launched that way. And in fact, the funniest part of the interview was, well, I mean, he really, obviously was a mature talent already. I mean, a capable filmmaker, but by the same token, a college student. So I was asking him then, you know, we're talking in the spring and the Maryland Film Festival is coming up in a month or so. And, you know, I didn't ask like outright, well, are you nervous or that kind of thing? But I was sort of getting at that, like, you know, this is like a big deal for you. And what he said to me was, and I have the exact quote here, he says, "I think I have to get a date so I don't arrive at the theater by myself." And I thought that's how I would be if I were 21 and my movie's about to premiere. I wouldn't worry about the movies. Like, who am I going to take? You know, I don't want to bring my mom. You know, it's kind of embarrassing. You know, I have a significant other there. Now, the thing with Mike Flanagan then is he's now about 46 as we speak, give or take. And he's made several films that we're going to talk a lot about genre here, because he's done at least the film we're talking about, Life of Chuck, is based on a 2020 novella by Stephen King. OK, and Mike Flanagan has done a couple of other films directly based on Stephen King material, Gerald's Games, Dr. Sleep. So, you know, that's and this is where we get into like the horror slash fantasy category, because Flanagan also has directed a film version of Edgar Allan Poe's Fall of the House of Usher a few years ago. And so we're getting to that realm of the macabre, of horror, of fantasy. And that's what brings us right up to date here with this particular film, because the film Life of Chuck is very much I would say fantasy oriented in the sense that it's the sort of fictive narrative where the narrator, Nick Offerman, does take us through it. And as Marie mentioned earlier, it's told in three acts, but these are three acts that are told in reverse chronological order. And so it's that kind of a film where from what you see at the get-go, it's then going to take you back. And in that respect, the title character, the main character, Chuck, Charles Chuck Krantz, played by Tom Hiddleston, is a 39-year-old accountant. So that's who he would be in what I'll call the present day moment. And he, you know, and he's somebody who is suffering from a brain tumor. And so there's an issue of medical issues, obviously, and also in terms of family relations, which we'll talk more about. But then where it starts to get complicated, just simply in the telling, is that there are going to be three actors actually playing him. We have Hiddleston playing him at the age of 39. There's another actor playing him at 17. There's another actor playing him at 11. There are actually four actors involved. There's Hiddleston playing him at 39. There's Jacob Tremblay playing him at 17. There's Benjamin Pashek at 11. And Cody Flanagan, the director's son, how's that for nepotism? The director's son playing him at 7. So we actually have four actors playing him. It's never confusing, but you know, as a viewer, you have to make those leaps too, don't you? And that does keep you alert, because you find yourself trying to track it backwards. But then when you have a total of four actors playing that title character, what to make of that? Now, it's an interesting setup. I had major reservations about the film and actually ultimately didn't care for it that much. And my major reservation is that for all the attention that goes into having four actors play the one character and all that kind of incremental detail in phases of his life, I think the character himself is fairly superficial. I don't think there's a lot spinning around this character. I don't think we know much of he's a bit, I don't want to say he's a cipher because that's pushing it too far, but we don't know that much about him. Now, admittedly, he's supposed to be sort of just like a straight on everyday accountant, blah, blah, blah. But that doesn't speak well of accountants then, because there's just not a whole lot to say about this guy. And I think it's like a lot of activity swirling around, not a hollow center, but not a center as fully realized as it might be. That's one major reservation. The second major reservation I have about it is for all those shifts in time and in character placement and this and that, running through the film is an overall tone that I felt was cloying after a while. In other words, there's a lot of like really heavy duty issues here, medical and familial and so on. And the film itself is constantly mixing moods and tones. It's shifting here and there. But overriding that or running through all that is a kind of feel good quality that somehow, you know, okay, well, you're dying of cancer, but, you know, and okay, you know, I want to look on the upside too, but I thought the film itself was just a little bit hippy dippy, you know, kind of feel good aura to it that could ride you through everything. And that's why a lot of the references that came along just felt facile. And there are a lot of cultural references here. Everybody from Carl Sagan to Gene Kelly gets name checked.
And Walt Whitman.
And actually the Walt Whitman connection is essential here because the song of myself is quoted, and particularly the line "I contain multitudes." But for me, the real letdown in that specific respect is that I don't find multitudes within Chuck. You know what I mean? I think Chuck is a really flat character, but the Walt Whitman poem would suggest that this man himself has all these facets to him. I just don't see them in the film itself. I think it's a clever concept or conceit directly pulled from the Stephen King that I think just kind of rides the surface of that. And this is, again, where the two films can be, the films we're talking about, Eddington and Life of Chuck, are very different, but a connecting thematic thread is that both of them tinker with genre expectations. And I think this is also a film that gives you all kinds of cultural references, all sorts of genres. But is it a mashup? Is it a mix-up? What is it? It's just like almost like in the scripting, too much cleverness is not necessarily a good thing. You know, it's just like, well, let's do this and let's do that. And what am I left with at the end? I just think the main character, as I keep saying, is just is a little bit, not quite a blank, but a quasi-blank.
You got that cue in there again.
I got another cue.
There are 39 clocks in the movie, which I thought was a clever thing to do. One thing that worked for me, which might have seemed cloying and probably to some people would seem schmaltzy, but I like schmaltzy, was the voiceover. You know, you're being told this story, you know, the voiceover. I liked that. I thought it worked for the story. I'm with you that it's missing a huge piece. But, you know, I did read the short story. So, you know, this is what they had to work with. I mean, you see him at 17 and then the next time you see him, even though you're doing this backwards, is 39. I mean, that's a lot of years in between, like crucial years where he would have met his wife and had kids and. An accountant or, you know, some sort of there's a whole chunk missing that must have been the good stuff.
Well, Marie, just to reinforce what you're saying there, and as I mentioned earlier, because we have several actors playing Chuck, yes, at 39 and then at 17 and then at 11 and then at 7. But I agree with you that, you know, if a character goes from like 7 to 11, it's an easy enough transition to make, right? Or even from like 11 to 17. I know a lot changes in the teen years, but still you can sort of track. But to go from 17 to 39, you make a really good point. It almost seems, goodness knows, I'm not sure I want like even more actors playing Chuck. But Marie, you make a really good point. It would be interesting to have somebody playing him at, let's say, age 30, because 30 is at about the point where, you know, you're still a young adult, but you know, you can see middle age on the horizon. Instead, to jump from 17 to 39, that's a huge jump. And I agree with you on that. That's one of the places where, even though it's never confusing, you almost felt like there's something missing. Like if you want to track the history of a marriage, you know, that's like a lot of years that just don't quite get mentioned, or they get mentioned in sort of retrospect. So that's a really good point you make. How many more installments we'd want? Now, in the source novel or novella, does it also make that complete jump, like from 17 to 39?
It does. It does. What's interesting, though, is the way it starts out, it's, you know, a teacher, which you sort of expect must be at the school where he goes, the child version of Chuck, and a nurse, and they're dealing with the end of the world. And those two characters are very interesting. And I could see them containing multitudes because you're seeing them like right in the grip of something important happening. And you get to see what they're like and that they used to be married, but they still get along. And that's the kind of note, I think, since it starts there, I think that they try to carry that through the whole movie, that everybody, no matter how ordinary, contains multitudes. And the dance sequences are delightful.
Yeah, that's one thing to say on behalf of this character here is that, you know, he has sort of a straight-laced profession. And yet, for reasons the film does explain quite well, he likes to dance. And there are some really delightful dance numbers within the film itself. You've also identified one of the things I really do like about the film among the secondary characters. The high school teacher is played by Chiwetel Ejiofor. And it's a really good performance. It's a well-scripted character. There's more substance, I think, to that character. The film's more grounded with him than with some of the other characters. And it also does at least raise some of the issues there in terms of who's married now, who was married to each other before. I mean, it'd take a while to get into all that, right? But you have some exes involved here in terms of ex-spouses. And it does actually give the film, I think, a little bit more substance. And the third thing you mentioned that I would reinforce very much so is the narration by Nick Offerman. It does have a kind of dry, straightforward, you know, but in a way that makes you smile. It's not ha-ha funny. And the reason it's not is because he's so dry and droll with things that he says that you kind of smile as you're listening to it. So, and I think that actually really helps the film in terms of, you know, a narrative tone, a narrator literally speaking to us that helps to connect what otherwise could be like overly arbitrary or abrupt transitions. You know, you're telling the story backwards. You got three acts. You got all these actors playing the character. What's going to pull it together? I think the narration helps to give it at least a semblance of cohesion.
And the fact that it gives it a sense of that you're being told a story. So I also liked the movie for the fact that I like it when I see a movie that I feel like, okay, I've never seen that before, or I haven't seen it done that way. So a little bit clumsy in the execution, but overall, I thought it was a pretty good movie. But that brings us to the end of our show. But don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Thank you for listening to Dragon Podcast. You can find this episode and all other Howard Community College podcasts available for your listening pleasure on all streaming platforms, as well as Podbean at podbean.com/dragonpodcast. Thank you for listening.